Good almost afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming to this Mindful Munching lunchtime lecture. Barb Janes has been a friend of the center for a long time. She is currently in ministry at Crescent Fort Rouge United Church, and in her time there, she's established Crescent Fort Rouge as a center for the arts and spirituality. Barb is a lover of the theater and of the arts, and a writer and actor and playwright in her own right. And this last spring, she was on sabbatical doing some research for a McGeechee scholarship into the interface and the interaction between the arts and the church. And her upcoming book may be called Inviting Wonder.
Maybe a book.
And we are very pleased that she's joined us today to give us some insights into the arts and hospitality. Thanks, Barb.
I can't take the credit for Crescent's relationship with the arts. That was going on before my arrival there, but it's one of the premier kind of venues for choral music and instrumental music because of its great acoustics. So when I was thinking about sabbatical, I want to express some thanks to Charlotte, who kind of prodded me along this path and encouraged me to apply for the McGeechee, which I'm now not so terribly thankful about now that I have to produce something. So what I'm going to give you is kind of the Reader's Digest version of what the congregation heard from me when I got back kind of into full swing in September. As Scott said, I took the sabbatical last spring. I started on Maundy Thursday, which I would highly recommend to anybody in ministry. It was the best Easter I ever had. And I'm not going to show you that part of it. I went to St. John's Abbey in just outside of Minneapolis for that weekend to experience Benedictine hospitality, which I did in spades. And I have way too many pictures of that, so I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. Because between St. John's Abbey and St. James and the refinery in Saskatoon, there was the R&R part of the sabbatical, which was a month in Spain. So that's kind of a natural break in my brain. So I was curious about churches that seem to be doing this hospitality to the arts well, and visited both St. John's, St. James Anglican in Saskatoon, which has the refinery, which we'll talk about in a moment, two churches in Cleveland, Ohio, Trinity Episcopal Cathedral and Old Stone Presbyterian. And then from there it was to Kingston, to Sydenham Street, and then to Toronto, to Trinity St. Paul's. Some of the churches are doing arts as a kind of standalone, or not necessarily connected with worship, and others are much more integrated in arts and worship. So actually I became curious about St. James when I was in Saskatoon for some other Con Ed event and out for a run in the morning, and I saw this sign and just about fell off my feet. What is this? This refinery thing. And a lot of what I discovered, I think, bears up some of the stuff that Leslie and her team were doing with Emerging Spirit around visible signs of hospitality. So there's a lot of pictures of church signs in this presentation. St. James is located just in an ideal spot for hospitality to the arts in Saskatoon. They're just a block off Broadway. They're in between kind of the artistic bohemian neighborhood and the university. So they've got a good draw. As we all know, banners give a really festive, welcoming appearance and a really high visibility in the neighborhood. The refinery, which is housed in what used to be the freestanding parish hall, sees 600 visitors a week on average. They have a reception room. This is not a great picture of it. My apologies. This is in the, as you walk into the refinery, this former parish hall, you enter onto a landing, so accessibility is a bit of an issue. You have to go either downstairs or up. So this is the basement. which has been transformed into an art gallery. You notice that there's all these wonderful soft furnishings. There's nothing that looks like a church basement here. It's a space that's used for receptions, visual arts shows. You can see some paintings hanging there. Also on the same level is a smaller meditation room, maybe about half the size of this room, and an office that can also serve as the box office for events that are happening there, and the typical kind of galley church kitchen, which also works for the receptions for various arts groups, wine and cheese and that kind of stuff. That's a really bad shot of the meditation room, dim lighting. One of the things that really excited me in my conversation with folks at St. James and the refinery was that the key leadership has no expectation that the work of the refinery is going to bring in more members or more money into the church. There have been a few people wander in via that route, and that's been great, but they've been very few. Rather, they're clear that this is their ministry to the wider community in which they live, and they're clear that this ministry of the building is offered freely with no strings attached, no expectation. So in a good year, the refinery breaks even. In a not-so-good year, the congregation makes up the difference and keeps it afloat. And they were cagey about how often which happens, but I think it pretty much breaks even. That's the performance space in the upstairs of the refinery building, a black box style theater. Can host music, dance, and live theater. Seats about 125 people. One of the brilliant things that St. James did was they hired an arts administrator to look after the refinery. They didn't hire a church person, and I think that's key to their success. Cynthia is the administrator, and she came, she was already a board member of one of the local theater groups, 25th Street Theater. She was looking for a change in career and wanted to move into arts administration. So actually she started there as a volunteer, and then the parish council very quickly realized if they were smart they'd be paying her because she was doing such a good job. She already had the connections into the theater and the arts communities. So she was able to get players to the table and broker some initiating relationships. They had 25th Street Theater, the French language company Troupe du Jour, and I think Shakespeare in the Saskatchewan was also looking for a winter venue. So those three were the kind of initiating groups. They got all the lights from 25th Street Theater, for instance, which was great, and then the parish built risers for the seating and that kind of stuff. There are now several small theater groups that hold their seasons, their complete seasons there, so you can buy this package of five or six plays that will be going on there. The other thing that was key, I think, about hiring Cynthia was the artist didn't ever have any suspicion that this was a recruiting strategy on the part of the church, because she was known and trusted. That she wasn't going to be out to evangelize them or recruit them. She sees her job as very much a balancing act. The refinery, as well as doing the live theater and those kind of pieces, also is extremely busy with things like Tai Chi and yoga and those kind of classes. Before the refinery became the refinery, it had been rented out for like 25 or 26 years by a Ukrainian dance troupe. And the dance troupe decided to relocate, so that kind of sent the congregation into a tailspin about, oh my God, what do we do with this space now? Scary, scary. So Cynthia's been very careful to keep a balance of renters rather than relying on one that may or may not come to fruition. So there's a wide variety of stuff going on there all the time. They've also been pretty clear about wanting to use the refinery in terms of the classes as a place for people who are just starting their careers. So if somebody's for the first time teaching yoga, that's great. If they come to Cynthia and they say, I want to book 3 nights a week, she just says, it's time for you to move to a different space. and we'll bring in another person who's learning. She was a really exciting person to talk to. She says one of the things that really excites her about her job is the overlap as people are bumping into each other and connecting, the way that people have to deal with one another. So she says, so the yoga students have to deal with the crazy theater people upstairs, and the theater people have to deal with the Tai Chi class. The 12-step program has to get their instructions on where they're going from the weird gay guy upstairs. So they're always forced to deal. And she says they can't silo, and it's amazing how much we are changed by sharing space with one another. With the help of a young person in my congregation, I was able to set up a blog. She walked me through that. And that was a great way for me to be able to keep some communication going with the congregation while I was on the road and traveling and offering some reflection. So that was kind of fun. On to Cleveland. Cleveland's been trying to reinvent its downtown, and I was really struck when I was there that it felt very similar to the Exchange District of Winnipeg, and some of the same issues around people's fear, suburban people's fear of going downtown, and then the racial overlay is much more pronounced or more obvious in Cleveland than it is here. So a mural. Some of the reinvention, the city asked fine art students at the university to redesign some of the kind of public fixtures, so new flower pots that are supposed to look like the paper that a bouquet would come in was one of those. New garbage cans, new grates around the trees. The main street where Trinity Cathedral is Euclid Avenue, which used to be called Wampum Street. So the images along the grading are lifted from that history. Cleveland has one of the biggest theater complexes outside of New York City, I was astonished to find out. And I was very saddened when I was there that the only thing going on in them was high school grads. there's a lively arts community there. Also, the Cleveland Art Museum is a fabulous and worth a look. It won my tourist dollar over the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I did not go to. So this is a transit shelter for the trolley line just outside, just on the edge of the theater district. And those strange little neon things are supposed to resemble the legs of the chorus line. But if... kind of kicky. But if you look behind at the sign, you'll see a similar story to Downtown Portage. Rooms for rent, space for rent. The trolley line had been dug up in a redevelopment project that took a couple of years, and the result of that was a lot of the businesses just folded shop and moved. So there is a real sense of the downtown being empty. I arrived there on a weeknight, about 8 o'clock at night, checked into my hotel and went out to find a newspaper, and I couldn't. Nothing was open. One of the things I discovered about Cleveland is that it's in a severe financial crash. People are exiting that city second only to New Orleans. The steel industry has tanked. It's really desperate. So this was quite disturbing news to me because Trinity Cleveland, which we'll get to in a moment, was one of the other muses for the whole project. But anyway, I digress. Old Stone Church is a Presbyterian church in the downtown. They've done a great job with their signage and banners again. They're right opposite. There's Old Stone, then there's a big public square, and then the kind of transit central hub in a big monster office building. So anybody coming in and out of the downtown visually is seeing this church. The person I talked to there is the sister-in-law of David Giuliano, and she's working there in CE, in the heart, the commuter neighborhood. The park it's an interesting little place. There are electrical outlets in the park so that street people can plug in their shavers and have a shave in the morning. And street musicians can plug in their amps and make noisy music. The signage, when I was there, there were people coming in for the noonday visits. One of the big courthouses is a block away, so some people on jury duty wandered in. There were also some tourists who came through, and they had volunteers from the congregation who would greet people and give them a little tour and try to answer any questions that they had. Well, this is what you can do if somebody in the congregation is really generous and gives you $94,000. This room had been known as the ladies' parlor and was described to me as looking like the inside of a funeral home with dark wood paneling. There was literally a red velvet rope that locked the room off so nobody had access, and, you know, that whole thing about permission to use the dishes and all that stuff. Someone in the congregation wanted to make a donation in memory of her spouse to transform this room into an art gallery. So Beth Giuliano was pretty much given free hand to design this herself, which was just brilliant. One of the things they did that was very wise, I think, was they created a mandate for the gallery. And the mandate is, our gallery has a strong vision to exhibit local, regional, and national artists whose art speaks to the downtown core and its vitality. The gallery seeks artists who strive to be an active part in the dialogue towards the city's faithful revitalization. So, given that mandate, that keeps the art edgy. Beth was telling me she had an inquiry from somebody who phoned her up and said, I paint pictures of angels and I use holy water from my church for the water part, and could I have a display? And she was able to just say, I'll send you the mandate if you can tell me how what you do addresses the mandate. So it's a wonderful little clearinghouse. When I was there, there was this great exhibit. A group had worked with high school students in three different locations, in Euclid, which is very near Cleveland, in Savannah, Georgia, and in Sierra Leone. So they'd given cameras to these high school students and asked them to record both by photo and in text, what are the obstacles you are facing to your education? So this is one of the photos from that. This one is great. The young guy that was reflecting on his experience talked about, and he was actually invited to come and speak to the congregation and tell this story. He felt an obstacle to education was that he doesn't fit with his peers. He would much rather sit at home and read Star Wars comic books than go out partying or whatever else the kids are into. And his talk was so moving, apparently, from what Beth said. A lot of parents kind of could feel that kind of pain of adolescence, that weird universal feeling like, I'm the only one. I don't fit. Other kids wrote about how working for a living interferes with their education and the need for work. So again, like the refinery, it's a really attractive space. They had big bucks to do it. They splurged out on carpet, good furnishings. There's a small kitchen for receptions, and there was a lovely story, an elderly man in the congregation who's fairly deaf and has a hard time mostly in the kind of crowded coffee hour scenarios. He has volunteered to be the bartender for all of the receptions because it's always a one-on-one conversation through the window, and the choice is really easy. Is it red or white? And so he's developed his own little ministry of hospitality around that piece. The gallery is located as you enter the main door of the church towards the office area. And like most of our churches, it's very well used. So people coming in for their yoga class or their 12-step meeting or whatever often take a little side trip into the gallery to see what's going on. Also, because of its location so close to the main office, the administrator can keep an eye on things in terms of security, so they don't have to worry too much about that. It's just another one of the sandwich boards. And advertising as a... Okay, I'm going to embarrass myself. Is it Wi-Fi or Wi-Fi? Wi-Fi, thank you. spot. They did talk about offering coffee to people as they came in, but they... You know, two doors down from the church is a coffee shop, so they didn't want to cut into that person's business. And that person, the coffee shop owner, now refers people over to the church gallery to access internet. And so there's been a nice little symbiotic relationship there. This is the Monster Sanctuary. Some of the windows are by Tiffany. It's this big old historic stone pile. Again, like all of our churches are doing these kind of things, but I think the signage really helps people grasp something's going on in here. Like, I just think most of our churches are like the Masonic Lodge. It's this mystery to most people about what's happening behind the wooden doors. So, that's the Presbyterians. Trinity Episcopal Cathedral is further down the block. So Old Stone's kind of at this end by that big transport hub. Then there's that theater district, and then Trinity. Across from Trinity is the University of Cleveland. I think it was Carol Fletcher at Transcona United who put me on to this piazza theology, which I just found really exciting. Folks know what a piazza is? The courtyard in most European cities have several of them. Usually on one side of the piazza is a church. On the other side is the town hall or some kind of civic government office. There's often a fountain. And then there's shops and restaurants and bars, etc., all the way around. So it's a real gathering spot, a real meeting place. And it's a good model for us to think about in terms of our use of space. Tracy Lind, who's the dean of the cathedral, generated this piazza theology based on a legend about St. Angela, who is the founder of the Ursuline order. And she urged her followers to be a piazza rather than to be in a cloister, but to be out where the people are, to stand with Christ at the crossroad, steadfast as an olive tree. Isn't that lovely? Yeah, so when Tracy Lind was called to the position of dean, the cathedral itself was undergoing a renovation, so in part of her application process, she espoused this image of the piazza as a place, as an image for the churches, and she got the job. So the renovations proceeded. Again, just the letting folks know what's going on inside the building. It's like so obvious, and we don't do it. We don't do it well. I was there on a weekday morning, walked into the sanctuary. The doors were wide open. Nobody was around. I don't know whether there's closed circuit TV, but nobody came to make sure I wasn't going to burn the place down. It was just open. The organist was practicing. So that sense of signifying welcome was quite palpable there. The labyrinth in there is on a side chapel of the sanctuary. And even the altar cushions have all been embroidered. So there's a real sense of art at work here. Trinity Commons, again, the signage. And this is the outdoor garden of the piazza. So you can see across the street is the university, and there's a couple of people there having lunch. It's lovely to have that kind of sense of sacred space in the middle of this bustling from 9 to 5 downtown. They also have a fair trade cafe, Cafe Aroma. Good food, I'd recommend it. Which is also committed to living wages for the staff and serving a variety of vegetarian, vegan, and kind of omnivore choices. So at noon, it was a happening little place. The church makes sure that their newsletters are always in the, you know, along with the coffee news and those other tatty things that are in coffee shops, so people can pick that up and check it out. This is the interior lobby of the kind of piazza image, so you can see the kind of flowing scents on the floor. And these walls on the back, those greenish walls, are actually fountains. So that's picked up the European notion of the piazza fountain. A very welcoming kind of atmosphere. It's also supposed to symbolize the various bodies of water that flow through the region, if you wanted to get into the more technical, local, theological stuff. So in her writing, Tracy Lynn says, Trinity Commons is becoming, this was before the crash, is becoming everything we hoped it would be. University students and faculty are crossing the street for the first time in decades. People are gathering to work on peace, justice, and environmental issues. Artists are creating in the light and shadows of the great cathedral, and seekers are discovering this sacred public space. When I walk into the cafe, I frequently see people reading our cathedral newsletter as they drink a cup of coffee. When I go into the cathedral, I often watch pilgrims silently walking the ancient way of the labyrinth. When I enter the 10,000 Villages gift shop, which is right beside the cafe, I hear conversations about fair trade. When I gaze into the gallery, I see exhibits that explore the intersections between art, religion, and daily life. In a short time, Trinity has become a place of culture, charity, commerce, conversation, and collaboration, a commons for making connections, and a holy place to worship, celebrate, create, and hang out. Those are just the goings-on on offer the day I happened to be there. However, I spent a day with Tracy, and a lot of that was kind of doing pastoral care, as because of the economic meltdown. I was doing the pastoral care, yes. She said, you caught me on a really bad day. So there's real concern about how sustainable this is in the face of the economic meltdown, parishioners who have lost their homes and the mortgage stuff that went on. It's a real, the sustainability is a real issue. I've tried to make contact with her again since coming home, but we've not been able to do that for a variety of reasons. One of the things that Trinity was moving on to do was they got a grant from the Episcopal Church to do a pilot project on a culture of call and to try to empower people again in the congregation to seize their calling in the community. One of the things that we talked about was the tension that we have as Christians. Like whenever Jesus heals somebody, what's his instruction to that person?
Don't tell
and
go back to your village.
When people come to our church to be healed, we want them to stay. So we were reflecting on the number of people who came into her congregation, often out of some life crisis, a crisis about sexual identity or a change in relationship, bereavement. They hang around for 5, 6, 10 years, do some great work for the church, get healthy, and they move on. And we all feel betrayed by that instead of saying, well, that's our job. That's what we should. Yeah, how dare you get better and leave us? So, here's an interesting piece to think about. From there, I went to Kingston, to Sydenham Street United, and again, the signage thing, signs of welcome. Again, open doors. I just love this thing in the narthex of this is who we've been as church, celebrating their own history. Elizabeth McDonald, who's in ministry there, read a book and got this idea about doing some work with the artists who are already in the congregation and pulling out of them some artistic responses to resurrection stories. So they looked at the great 50 days of Easter period as the time to do that. She called together some people who she thought would be kind of keen on the project, a visual artist in the congregation, a poet, some other folks who were kind of arts boosters, and at some point the music person got into the mix as well. So they looked at all the resurrection appearance stories, and then they narrowed that down to one for each of those Sundays in the great 50 days. Did some kind of Bible study on each of those stories. And then the artists went away and worked independently. So the visual artist created a visual piece. The poet wrote a contemporary psalm in response to the story. And the music person, who at that time was a student from Queens, was initially asked, could you just play some meditative music during worship when these things are presented? And he went away and composed some meditative things for the pieces in worship. So this is one of the pieces. The project was called Light into Light. So each week in worship, a new painting would, or a new collage would be unveiled. and a new psalm would be read by the congregation in worship, and then there'd be this silent time of meditation. So now, at this point, a couple of years down the road, all of the psalms and the works of art are hung in the congregation. And Sydenham would be similar to Crescent Fort Rouge in terms of being a concert venue in the community. So lots of folks are in and out of the building. They see these expressions of faith and hopefully.
Would it be artist piece?
I don't know that. I think it was labor of love. That's a good question. Yeah, isn't it always? Because they're members of the congregation, they should just give this up willingly. I know that the artist had a real concern that her pieces were also bulletin covers during that time, so they all had to be framed ahead of time. They were professionally photographed so that the color and all of those kind of senses would come through. This is from the story of Doubting Thomas. One of the things I liked about the visual art was, even though they're kind of obviously biblical stories, they were all set in a Canadian context. So here we have Northern Lights. There's another one where there are trilliums in the picture. Norm Esden may be known to some of you. He was a frequent contributor to the Worship Resource Gathering. He did the poetry stuff, does a lot of stuff around stewardship. So he was the poet who wrote companion pieces, except they didn't know how companionable they'd be until the great unveiling. So for this one, his words were, this is Doubting Thomas, who Norm has renamed Honest Thomas. Bless you, wise and holy one, for giving us honest Thomas, for one brave enough to reveal what's on his mind and in his heart, for one whose daring to ask and to seek enables us to find what we neither ask nor seek. This series of artworks won a Bene Visual Arts Award from the Ministry and Liturgy magazine of 2010, so they're pretty excited about that. On to a place that will be known to many in this room, Trinity St. Paul's. And Nora's going to keep correcting me because I always mix up which church was... It's an amalgamated congregation.
By three, yes.
This is a testament to my bad photography, but I would also say it really gives a sense of the context of that place with the busy street reflected in the sign and all the stuff that's going on in that building. It's just great. So Trinity St. Paul's is located in the heart of downtown Toronto, right near a subway stop. One of them amalgamated with the other in the early 80s.
St. Paul's and Avenue Road.
Thank you, St. Paul's Avenue Road. And St. Paul's already had in its building this kind of center. It was known as a hubbub for kind of social justice groups, arts groups. In the hippie days, St. Paul's was then fairly close to Yorkville Avenue, where the draft dodgers and hippies hung out, and they were adopted by some of the women in the congregation of St. Paul's. So there wasn't that adversarial kind of relationship to the community. So when the amalgamation happened, St. Paul's brought the St. Paul's Center folks into the Trinity building, and I'm sure there's been lots of shifts in terms of who those groups are over the years. Tafo Music, which is on the list there, is one of the premier partners and one of the longest tenants in the building. And there's a real relationship of love and respect that I experience between the orchestra and the congregation. And they do they tour extensively, but they do a fair amount of their season out of Trinity St. Paul's as well. Trinity St. Paul's is naming itself as a center for faith, justice, and the arts. And again, that's signage in the narthex as you go in. So any visitor to the building sees that right away and says, oh, this is the kind of church that this is. Signage on the outside of the building tells all the passers-by about some of the work that the church is about. I don't know if that would fly at our church, Cam, to put up a sign like that. It would be a big fight. So I just think that's great. Tafel music is I only know this because I read their website, a German word that means table music or music for the feast. They were founded in 1981. They do a huge amount of concerts annually at Trinity St. Paul's. The congregation has really kind of adopted them. Many people in the congregation are subscribers to the series, and several members of the orchestra are members of the congregation as well. And a few years ago, they had this really interesting conversation where Trinity St. Paul's said to Tafel Music, "We'd like you to consider trading places with us so that you would own the building and we would be the tenants." And apparently it was a live conversation for a while, but I thought it really underlined the respect and the trust they have in one another. The Tafel Music finally said, "We don't want to be landlords, we want to make music, that's what we want to do. Darn it, for the church." Blessing of the cyclists and the bikes. This was a really neat partnering relationship that happened, or arrangement rather, that I think is, there's hope that this will become an annual event. So the worship focuses on the theme, then there's the lunch, and then Tafel Music does some great stuff later in the afternoon, blessing of the cyclists and the bikes. Great kind of partnering, and hopefully would bring people who maybe would go to a Tafel Music concert may show up in worship, or may just come for lunch, and the cyclists may stay on for the concert, etc.
Interesting twist on cursing the cyclists and the bikes.
Yeah. Yes. I wanted to ask, do you bless them if they're not wearing a helmet? While I was in Toronto, this the Luminato Festival was on, which is this huge, all kinds of arts stuff going on. And I saw this amazing play called Homage, which told the story of Hayden Davis, who's a sculptor. This is a piece that he did that was originally placed at the community college in Sarnia, this wooden piece. And there's a scene in the play where, rather than in a community college, he's pitching the idea of this sculpture to a small town council meeting. And they're all looking at his sketches saying, "What the hell is that? What's it supposed to be?" So rather than tell them what it's supposed to be, he takes them on this imaginary walk, and the stage directions in the play are great as he takes them on this walk. So, okay, when we're looking at it from this angle, we're coming up Maple Street, and we're looking through it, and we see the library on the other side of the sculpture. And then when we come up from this angle, we're looking through it, and we see the children's playground. And as he's describing it and walking around, gradually more and more people in the town council start to walk with him and to see it through his eyes. And for me, it was this big aha of, you know, grasp of the blindingly obvious, that art isn't only something we look at, but we look through, and it informs our vision, informs what we see. The tragedy in this story is that 25 years later, the community college took a bulldozer and razed it.
They didn't move it.
So there was a big piece in the play around who owns art. Like, once you buy a piece of art, do you have to go back to the artist and say, "Do you want to buy this back because I'm finished with it? Or is it yours to do with what you wish?" But that's the experience of this play has made me think a lot more about how the art that we surround ourselves with influences our sense of vision and what we see and what we don't see because of the arts that we look at. And then I just ended my presentation to the congregation with, "Where do we go from here?" You like that signage? Yeah. Ours is not so great. Questions? Wonderings?
I've noticed a connection
between hospitality in the U.S., between the attempt to be hospitable to the arts and the Episcopal Church. The Episcopal Church seems to be doing tons. Mm-hmm. Do you agree, and have you pondered that connection at all?
I'm not a good church historian, but my sense is that the more liturgical churches are more art-friendly than the Protestant, the austere Scottish Kirk, and all those images of marauding Protestants in the 1500s smashing the statues and tearing down the icons and all of that piece. So I think we've got this really conflicted thing. I think most Protestant churches put their artistic expression into preaching, liturgy, and music. And we're really suspicious of visual stuff. Like I can remember as a kid believing that Catholics pray to their statues, right? They light candles. I mean, that's just... they have weird things. Well, and some of us would be long enough in the tooth to remember the fur over the image of Jesus laughing that came out. Oh my gosh, this is bizarre.
That was a United Church youth group leader.
Oh, was it? Oh, good. So there's this bizarre thing because, you know, one of the people I talked to said, it's really weird we have more art in our homes than we do in our churches. What's up with that? There was an interesting quote in McDermid's Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. In the DVD of that story, he talks to a Syrian Orthodox priest who says, in the Orthodox tradition, the theologians are artists. They paint icons. In the Western tradition, the theologians are philosophers. So right away we've got that kind of weird split, you know. When I was in Saskatoon, the church I was at amalgamated with another, and the congregation that joined us had several mentally challenged adults in their midst, one of whom really wanted to read scripture in worship. This is your question about standards. So I waited and waited until there was a time when there was only going to be one reading, and it was really easy words, and got the pulpit Bible open to the right spot, put the ribbon in, put post-it notes before, you know, here's where you start, here's where you stop, showed all this to him. When the moment came for him to read, he got up to the lectern, moved the ribbon, took out the post-its, turned the pages around, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is not going to be good. And you could just see the tension in the congregation rising the more he flipped. And then he started to read, and the passage was, love is patient, love is kind. Yeah, it was like a transformative moment. Yeah. So I think that thing about the standards have to be fluid. They have, you know, one person's best is not going to be the next person's best, but everybody does their best. And how inclusive are we going to be? Is there a place for the watercolor angels? I think the other piece, one of the kind people who's been reading my initial stabs at writing about this stuff raised with me is that I've been saying the church, one of the things the church has is real estate. We're rich in space. But this reader said, but we also need people who are rich in hospitality. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. One of the things that's happened at Crescent Fort Rouge is Bill Gillis's incredible ministry with this radical music scene that I know nothing about, which started when he was still working in the conference office, and he'd pick up hitchhikers, get talking to them, and turns out, well, you know, they got a band. So he started, at their invitation, Bill says they're the ones who first showed hospitality to him. Bill started to go to these house parties on these sketchy neighborhoods. With really scary looking, to my mind, scary looking people. And then they said to Bill, can we do some concerts at your church? So those are happening. And he says they're always small, 40 or 50 people, but there's always a kind of sense of wonder from the band when they get into the space and they see this beautiful space that's being made available to them. And there's always somebody, either in the band or the audience, who says, I never thought a church would let us do this. So there's that sense of hospitality that is really key to the whole thing. And I think also the letting go of results, not thinking this is a way to fill our pews again, this is a way to get back to the glory days we had. Because none of those people from the bands are coming on a Sunday morning. Hospital and hospitality come from the same root, eh? So somebody comes into our hospital, has some healing, and then they move on. And that's hard for us. It's really hard. And I would also want to say hospitality to the arts isn't the only thing that churches should be about, and it's not something that necessarily every congregation should be about. The place where we live is where our mission comes out of our community context. I always think of that, the Episcopal Church near the site of the World Trade Center. It was unscathed by the terrorist attacks, but then became the place where the rescue workers came for respite and care. That's a mission that's an accident of location, but was a ministry they sustained for 2 years, providing care to these folks, and now it's become the prime shrine of that event. Yeah, we never know what our context is going to lead us into.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Bard, for bringing some inspiration, some challenge, and I'm sure there's lots of thoughts and conversations that will carry on from this, but thank you for the time here.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott.